From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a territorial dispute between a Native tribe and non-tribal members centering on 337 square miles of northern Michigan.
The tribe has really been engaged in a long-planned public relations campaign to intentionally downplay the scope of what the tribe is seeking.
This is more of a protection for our character and our ability to be able to take care of our people within our homelands that our ancestors fought hard to secure this homeland for us.
And looking back to the early 70s and the Detroit Police decoy unit's stress.
After the first year of stress, Detroit is the number one city where civilians are getting killed. But it's also the number one city where police are getting killed.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Some of Michigan's top northern vacation destinations are at the heart of a lawsuit filed by the Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa Indians. This tribe argues a treaty signed in 1855 set the boundaries of a reservation that would cover 337 square miles of what is now parts of Emmett and Charlevoix counties. And that would include places like Harbor Springs, Petoskey, parts of Charlevoix. The federal lawsuit was filed in 2016 and is slowly making its way through the court. As that happens, residents and business owners who are not members of the tribe are voicing fears and concerns. With us now is Lance Boldry. He's with the Lansing office of Dykema, and he represents the Emmett County Lakeshore Association, as well as the Protection of Rights Alliance. And he's a former state tribal liaison for the state of Michigan under Governor John Engler. Lance, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
You have called this, I've seen it quoted, this is the biggest case ever to hit northern Michigan. Why is that?
Well, this is a 337 square mile area that we're talking about, roughly half of Emmett County and a big chunk of Charlevoix County, over which the entire jurisdiction of that area would shift in many ways away from state and local governments to the tribal governments.
And as you say, 337 square miles, it is certainly a significant piece of property. Now, we're not here now to litigate this suit because it's playing out in court proceedings. But as their representative, we want to talk about what your client's concerns are should the tribe be successful in this suit down the road, and to focus really on what is a dispute between neighbors. So break it down for us. What are the main concerns of the homeowners and the businesses you represent if the court eventually decides that a reservation was established over 160 years ago?
Sure. So the primary concern that the Emmett County Lakeshore Association has, as well as Protection of Rights Alliance, is number one, that the tribe and all of its members, all of the tribal members of the Little Traverse Bay Band, would essentially be free of all state and municipal regulation, including zoning regulation. So tribal members would be able to build what they want, where they want, on their properties, and not be subject to the same regulatory framework under which other businesses would compete. At the same time, in a number of important ways, the tribe itself would have jurisdiction over non-members, that is, over non-Indians, who conduct business within this entire 337-square-mile area. Businesses, to the extent that they are doing business with the tribe or tribal members, could face claims in tribal court. Liquor licensing could shift away from the state to also include licensing and regulation and taxation by the tribe. And environmental permitting decisions that are currently made by the state of Michigan would end up being made at first at the U.S. EPA and then could shift over to the tribe as well.
And I know there was a recent ad in the Petoskey News Review that cites a number of complaints, and as it says in the copy, according to lawyers defending the suit, which I presume includes you, and one of the concerns raised is gambling could rapidly expand in the county.
That is a possibility. That is not an advertisement that was run by either the Emmett County Lakeshore Association or PORA. And perhaps overblows concerns to some degree, but it is absolutely the case that if this area is declared reservation land, then all of that land would be immediately eligible for gaming activities. And what we've seen in other states where tribes have sort of that large geography that's open in that fashion is we've seen the tribes start to place slot machines and electronic games of chance, really class two machines, in convenience stores, in gas stations, et cetera, that may not even be tribally owned.
So is the basis of your clients' concerns what has happened elsewhere in the U.S.?
Yes, it really is. And so I think there's been a lot of downplaying of the concerns, certainly by tribal representatives, and understandably so. But these are all situations that have arisen in other states in similar cases like this one. They were all potential impacts that were brought to the court as part of our clients moving to intervene in the lawsuit and seek to defend those private citizen interests. At that point, the judge agreed that these potential impacts not only exist, but are the basis that support the private parties having a role in the case.
Lance, has the Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa Indians, has the tribe communicated that these are indeed their intentions?
No, and in fact, what we have found through the course of the litigation is that the tribe has really been engaged in a long-planned public relations campaign to intentionally downplay the scope of what the tribe is seeking. So you often see tribal leaders talking about how this involves child welfare issues and other social issues, but it's really far broader than that. The tribe's constitution itself provides that the tribe's jurisdiction extends to any and all persons and activities within their claimed reservation, and the tribe's lawsuit specifically seeks a permanent injunction barring the state and the municipalities from asserting jurisdiction over tribal citizens and for interfering with the rights of the tribe and its citizens to be entirely free of state law and regulation. So this is far broader than the issues that the tribe has brought forward in public forums.
And certainly as part of the tribe putting its perspective out there earlier this month, the tribal chairperson of the Little Traverse Bay Bands, Regina Gasco-Bentley, she sent out a letter regarding this dispute. And I'm going to quote a little bit of her letter here. She said, "We ask our neighbors to honestly consider why would we permit the destruction of our only homeland? Why, as one of the region's largest employers, would we do anything to jeopardize the quality of life for residents of the appeal of the area or for visitors and their families?" So how do you answer that?
Well, I think we answer that actually looking at the tribe's own words and what we have discovered during the course of this litigation. The PR campaign for the tribe really has started at least a decade ago. In 2007-2008, tribal presentations on this lawsuit spoke about how the tribe's goal was to regulate and impact the activities of others, to regulate or co-manage the social and economic activities within the reservation. And why won't the tribe say that today? The same presentation that they had back in 2008 pointed out the need to position the claims that the tribe's going to make it easy or less frightening and give the general public practical and moral reasons to not oppose the tribe. So that's the lens that we view a lot of their current communications through.
Are you saying this is, in a sense, kind of a legal bait and switch?
It's not so much a legal bait and switch. The lawsuit really has this broad-brushed impact. It's more an intentional effort by the tribe to hide what those impacts are.
Now, the lawsuit is Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa Indians v. Snyder. And the tribe has said this suit is only against the governor. Why did your clients feel that they needed to voluntarily join this lawsuit along with two counties, three cities, and 11 townships? Why voluntarily join this as defendants?
Well, the lawsuit is nominally only against the governor, but the relief sought would have far broader ramifications than that. Again, the relief sought is not just against the governor, but it's an injunction against the state and municipalities from asserting jurisdiction over tribal citizens or interfering with tribal citizens' claim to be free from state law and regulation.
Lance, there is a long, long history in America of fear-mongering when it comes to Native tribes and their intentions towards non-Native people and groups. How does this history fit into this dispute, in your view?
Yeah, I think that makes the messaging very challenging. As the tribe themselves said some time ago, it does make it more difficult on practical and moral grounds for defendants to step up and oppose the tribe. But at the same time, when you look even as recently as 3 years ago, this tribe signed on to a tribal brief to the United States Supreme Court describing their interests as the interest of asserting civil adjudicatory jurisdiction over non-members. That is to say, they want the ability to have lawsuits against non-members brought in tribal court. So, yes, there is certainly a broader backdrop against which this case has to be considered, but the facts of the case and the impacts of the case are there and they're real.
Lance, the tribal chairperson has indicated that the tribe is open to mediation. Is that something your clients would consider?
Well, at this point, the state is the primary defendant. And no one, including the state, is prepared to engage in mediation at this point due to some of the comparisons that are really being made between this case and another case that was settled in the Mount Pleasant area. This is a far different matter here, and the tribe's relief is far broader, and we're still in early stages of this litigation. If the tribe were really to pare this back to just addressing child welfare-type issues, and those types of matters, then certainly I think there would be room for conversation.
Largely, this is about getting along as neighbors living in northern Michigan. So, Lance, if at some point the court decides in favor of the tribe and its claim, what is the way forward in order to get along?
That's an excellent question. I mean, I think if that were to happen, there would certainly be a hope that some of these disputes could be resolved through government-to-government negotiation and through resolution between the government's cooperative agreements and the like. The difficulty with that is once that decision is made, if that decision is made, the tribe can't necessarily preclude the types of arguments that its own tribal citizens might make, and that's part of the challenge with this case.
R. Lance Boldry is the attorney who represents groups opposing the suit filed by the Little Traverse Bay Band of Odawa Indians, seeking to recognize part of Emmett and Charlevoix counties as within a reservation boundary established by treaties in 1836 and 1855. Lance, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Up next, we'll hear from the tribal chairperson of the Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa Indians. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, we've heard the concerns of property owners and residents who are not members of the tribe that's seeking to reclaim 337 square miles of Emmett and Charlevoix counties, land they say is theirs based on the 1855 Treaty of Detroit. Now we turn to the other side of this lawsuit, and with us now is the tribal chairperson of the Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa Indians, Regina Gasco Bentley. Welcome to Stateside.
Why, thank you very much.
So as I said in my conversation earlier in the show with attorney Lance Boldry, we're not here to litigate the tribe's claim because that's going to eventually be decided in court. We want to explore what this dispute is between neighbors in northern Michigan. Can you start by telling us why is the tribe bringing this suit against Governor Snyder?
So actually, we just want him to reaffirm our Treaty of 1855 and, you know, to make sure that we have the jurisdiction over our tribal citizens that the treaty has in it.
And how long ago did the tribe begin to think about initiating this suit?
Well, we have been talking about it and working on it and reaching out in other directions. It's been, I'll say, a good 10 years or more that we have been working on different areas.
And why was that? What was the thinking when this started moving in this direction as far as how the tribe would benefit from a prolonged and complicated and honestly costly suit?
Well, with the way that the tribe we are, we've always been a government and stuff, but, you know, it's like there is gray areas or areas of concern with the state, you know, as to the tribe's jurisdiction within our, we say, within our boundaries here. And we are trying to have jurisdiction over our people. One of the big ones is, like, in tribal court and stuff, the jurisdiction over our own children and stuff.
Child welfare issues?
Correct.
The group that represents the property owners in Emmett County, the Emmett County Lakeshore Association, has been saying that people who did not see this lawsuit as a personal threat a year ago now feel there is a threat. And you have said there are misconceptions out there regarding the lawsuit and the tribe's intentions. What are those?
Well, actually, you know, it's very disappointing, we have a lawyer from downstate that come up and formed its own protection of rights alliances. And in doing that, he has come up and they have put out many false information and stuff. And,
such as? When you read things, what do you feel are the misconceptions?
Actually, they say that all the tax revenue will be redirected to the tribe. The tribal members will no longer pay property taxes and different things like that, which is all false.
And some of the other concerns that you're hearing. For example, there was an ad that was put in the Petoskey paper saying if the tribe is successful, existing local zoning and land use restrictions wouldn't apply to the tribe or its members, which could allow them to construct what was termed objectionable structures or businesses on any land they own.
The information that is put out there, it's like, you know, they're saying, you know, we could redo the land and, you know, like downtown Harbor Springs, put a McDonald's. You know, by the law, once the tribe buys the land and we put the land into trust, in which we have done for a number of years, we already have that ability. But we have not done that because we are here to, you know, help protect our land. We care about this property and the land up here.
One of the other points or concerns raised by people who are opposed to this suit is that state and local courts would no longer assert control over tribe members in almost all of Emmett County. The tribal court would have this jurisdiction.
Within the reservation, and that's another one where it's complicated, and that's why we had asked them to sit down to litigate. You know, there's things that, you know, that we will have to work out. We're more than happy to sit down and mediate and work out agreements. We've been good neighbors here. We do have, through some of our law enforcement and that type of thing, we have MOUs with our other local governments here, and that's things that can be worked out.
Explain what an MOU is.
A memorandum of understanding. We have one with Charlevoix County and Emmett County and now the city of Mackinac. And that's an agreement between the two law enforcements where they help each other, you know, if they come into a situation within our jurisdiction or county jurisdiction.
Regina, does your tribe's constitution spell out that the tribe's jurisdiction extends to any and all persons and activities within the claimed reservation?
That I would have to look that and review it. I'm sorry.
What about non-tribal members then? What do you see as far as tribal jurisdiction for non-tribal members, whether particularly, let's say, if you were to win your suit, Regina, ultimately, mm-hmm. How do you envision non-tribal citizens having their concerns addressed?
Non-tribal citizens would take their concerns to a state court.
Does the suit that the tribe has filed, doesn't it seek a permanent injunction barring state and municipalities from asserting jurisdiction over tribal citizens? So non-tribal citizens are wondering, what about them?
Actually, I'd have to get my legal to answer some of them questions.
One other question we had wondered about 3 years ago, that your tribe signed on to a tribal brief to the U.S. Supreme Court, and it asserted the tribe's interest in civil adjudicatory jurisdiction over non-members, which basically I'm wondering, would this mean the tribe would have civil disputes with non-members brought forward in tribal court, should you win?
Like I said, I would have to get with my lawyers and have them help me with that question. I'm sorry.
There is... and I don't need to tell you this, a very, very long history in this country of fear-mongering when it comes to Native tribes and their intentions toward non-Native people and groups. But how does this long history in America fit into the way this lawsuit is being received?
Well, I think the main thing that is happening here today is some of these people are putting this misinformation out there, and you're right, because of the history and the way we were perceived back then and stuff, they are putting the fear of the people in there with some a lot of this false information that the Indians are going to take over everything.
What do you say, Regina, to residents who say, yes, there were treaties over, you know, 160 years ago, and yes, there is a long, sad history between the United States of America and Native peoples, but I'm afraid if my land comes under tribal jurisdiction, I'll lose my voice and I won't get a say-so in decisions that affect where I live and how I live. What do you say to them?
The people just need to realize that this lawsuit is more about the jurisdiction and the homeowners within our reservations. We will not be taking anybody's land. That's a falsehood. We will not be taxing anybody. And they, you know, they will still have their state issue. This is more of a protection for our character and our ability to be able to take care of our people within our homelands that our ancestors fought hard to secure this homeland for us with the Treaty of 1855.
Are you open to mediation?
We are. We have reached out to them on several occasions.
What might that look like?
I would have to refer to our lawyers. But mediation, be able to sit down and discuss and work out some of these issues that, you know, there are some of the areas where they feel there are concerns.
How long do you expect this suit to play out in the courts?
Well, actually, they're at the deposition stage right now, and I think the trial is set to start in 2019, so it could go into 2020. But depending on the outcome, you know, it could be appeals to the courts and that type of thing.
Regina, more broadly, this really does seem to be about Northern Michigan neighbors getting along.
Mm-hmm.
If your tribe is not successful in this suit, what is the way forward for you and your non-tribal neighbors?
Actually, you know what? We have a great working relationship with our neighbors here, and we hope, no matter which way this comes out, that we can all continue to try and work together, you know, for the better of our people. I would just like to try and reassure the people of Northern Michigan, you know, that we have been neighbors for all these years, and we would like to continue to be good neighbors and work together. And the only thing that we are trying to do is to protect the character and the beauty of this area and the homelands for the next seven generations for our children, our future children.
Regina Gasco-Bentley is the tribal chairperson of the Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa Indians. Regina, thank you for talking with us today.
Thank you.
The United Nations considers a war stopped even more important than a war won.
If our cities go down, in my opinion, our nation will go down.
You have to think about your dream and what you want to do.
All we were trying to do was just get music for all people.
There is no getting away from the mounting headlines about water problems in Michigan, raw sewage overflowing from municipal systems into our Great Lakes, the PFAS chemicals being discovered in groundwater and more places in our state, and of course, the countless lead pipes, which played a key role in the Flint water disaster. But today, we are going back to pre-statehood Michigan. We're going to focus on one of our first known water crises. It was this week in 1834 that a cholera epidemic began in Detroit. Here to tell the story is the Michigan History Center's Rachel Clark. So, Rachel, it is 1834 in Detroit, so nearly 30 years since the Great Fire of 1805, which nearly destroyed the entire city. So set the stage for us. What was Detroit like in 1834?
Detroit was growing. It was starting to really turn into a bustling city. With the opening of the Erie Canal in 1805 and the rebuilding of Detroit, it starts to grow, not quickly, but it's growing. So it's the seat of the territorial government. We get a population of about 5,000. And newspapers are beginning. We get mail services expanding and the ports are expanding. So it's getting there.
What was the municipal water system like? Or perhaps I should ask, was there a Detroit water system in 1834?
Not like we understand today. Not at all. The residents of the city relied on wells, both public and private wells, as well as the Detroit River for their water sources. The wells typically weren't very deep. Some of them were, but a lot of them were quite shallow for wells. There also wasn't proper sewage system in the city. So basically human waste could easily also mix within that water system.
Which leads to the question, what conditions does cholera need to take root and thrive?
Well, I'm not an epidemiologist, and I'm not going to pretend to be, so this is quite a layman's explanation. But cholera is a bacteria, and it needs warm or humid weather to grow, and it likes water to spread. That's the easiest way for cholera to, and most common way for cholera to spread is through a water system.
And so for Detroit in the summer, if you're talking August 1834, you got it all, don't you?
Oh, yes, very. It's hot and humid, just like today and summers today. And so most bacteria similar to cholera like to grow in those hot and humid temperatures.
So for a lot of Gen Xers and those who are younger, they learned of cholera from playing the classic computer game Oregon Trail. So how does someone get exposed to cholera?
As I said, it spreads through the water system, and water generally gets contaminated with human feces when it is introduced into the water system and then grows from there. So people are using contaminated water in their drinking water, watering plants and vegetables that they're growing, cooking water. So that is the typical way that something like cholera spreads, and it spreads very quickly. You don't get cholera directly person to person. It's transmitted through that water. So the bacteria releases toxin into the intestines, which leads to severe dehydration and diarrhea.
And that takes care of the questions about the symptoms, and that is tremendously debilitating and can be life-threatening.
Absolutely.
How quickly, when this outbreak happened at this time in 1834, how quickly did it spread? And how far did it spread?
It spread very quickly, and actually, despite efforts of communities in and around Detroit, it did come out of Detroit. There were proclamations sent out to places like Ypsilanti and Monroe, giving people the permission to stop anybody who was attempting to leave Detroit. And Detroiters were very afraid. So they're trying to leave the city and get away from what's going on. And other communities are not letting them in or not letting them through without a doctor's note or some sort of guarantee that they are not infected, which you wouldn't know just by looking at a person necessarily.
And do we know of any, should we say, extreme behavior from parts of the other state in response to Detroit's cholera outbreak, apart from saying you can't come here?
So there was an earlier outbreak in 1832, a smaller one. And the town of Ypsilanti had a proclamation very similar to other towns where nobody from Detroit was allowed into Ypsilanti. And there are documents in the Archives of Michigan that outline an event where there was a group of men who blocked the road into Ypsilanti from anybody, but they actually stopped mail carriers. And that was a federal offense. And so they ended up in court, not only because it's a federal offense to stop the U.S. mail or to impede the U.S. mail delivery, but they also shot a horse, one of the carriage's horses, and shot at one of the delivery people. So when people are afraid, they do pretty drastic things, and this is one of the more drastic instances that I found.
Now, Rachel, I understand Detroit had a rather unique way to publicly acknowledge that someone had died from cholera, but it kind of backfired?
Yeah. So Detroiters, when someone would die, especially during an outbreak of some sort, they would ring the church bells. And so every time a person would die, the church bells would ring. But you're having those church bells ring all the time. And it creates a panic within the city. And as I said, people, once they realize how bad this is, they start to try to leave the city. They also, because they aren't quite sure how it's spreading, they also start looking to populations within the city that they think are responsible for it. The assumption back then was cholera was spread through sort of gases in the air or sort of smells and odors. So people got pretty panicked by the church bells ringing all the time.
And what populations did they think were the cause of it?
Poor minority. By 1834, you're getting an increase in the Irish coming into Detroit. And so immigrant populations are the ones that are typically targeted, but also poor.
How many people ultimately died?
Between the two epidemics of 1832 and 1834, you get in and around 700 people who succumb.
700 people.
Mm-hmm.
And then did cholera come back to Detroit at any point down the road?
It does. It returns in 1849, 1866, and then again in the 1870s. And then after the 1870s outbreak, you start to get doctors and scientists that are beginning to understand this bacteria and these epidemics a little better, how they're spreading and how to prevent them.
And when we think of this Detroit cholera outbreak in 1834, but the others as well, how do they ultimately come to an end? Cool weather?
The weather. These bacteria, as I said, like hot and humid weather. So as fall rolls into winter, the bacteria just doesn't like the cold weather as well. And these epidemics sort of just die down on their own.
That's the Michigan History Center's Rachel Clark. Thank you so much for sharing the story of Detroit's cholera epidemic, which was ravaging the city this week in 1834. And a good reminder to all of us how having safe drinking water can literally be a life or death matter. Rachel, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
These are dangerous days on Lake Michigan. High waves, dangerous currents, and today temperatures plummeted, bringing a risk of hypothermia. So far in August, 10 swimmers have drowned. Dave Benjamin is with the Great Lakes Surf Rescue Project, a nonprofit that tracks drownings. Benjamin says the most important safety steps people can take to prevent drowning is to flip, float, and follow.
What happens with drowning is somebody swims out past their physical ability, their endurance, and then they start to panic, and they're having a panic attack, and they exhaust themselves and they submerge. And what we need people to understand is when you get to that point where you start having the panic attack, the exhaustion, you need to do the opposite of your instinct. Your instinct is to fight to survive. You need to flip over on your back and float, relax, get some deep breaths in. So flip, float, and follow. Everything, your energy, your efforts, your concentration should be staying at the surface and continue breathing.
You'll find my extended interview with Dave Benjamin with lots of good information and the link to the Great Lakes Surf Rescue Project by going to the stateside page at michiganradio.org. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's one of the most controversial chapters in Detroit history. STRESS, an acronym for Stop the Robberies and Enjoy Safe Streets. This Detroit police decoy unit operated from 1971 until it was eliminated by Mayor Coleman Young in 1974. The stories from the STRESS years are dark and violent, and that's the focus of an award-winning documentary film, Detroit Under STRESS.
His last words were, "Oh, no," and I shot him right in the chest.
Black men were being hunted down. They were shooting them dead on the street.
The news media would blow everything that happened at STRESS out of proportion and made us feel like we were mass murderers.
They were judge, jury, and executioner.
We knew that if one of our guys got shot even, or killed, the other guy was gonna go down.
Detroit police had killed more people per capita than any other city in this country. And those people were black.
It was a terror unit.
STRESS operated with impunity.
Its producer and director grew up in Detroit, and as we are about to hear, has a very close connection to this story. David Van Wee, welcome to Stateside. It's so good to have you here.
Thanks very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Start by telling us, David, how you discovered the story of the STRESS units.
Yeah, well, a full disclosure. So my father was one of the STRESS officers that was involved in the decoying and the decoy crew with Ray Peterson. And when I grew up, my father did not wear a uniform. And I had no idea what he did. I was told that he worked for the city. And so, you know, as you get older, you get little bits and pieces. And I remember specifically when I was in college, I was in ROTC, and we're driving. I wanted to practice shooting. So my father takes me to the gun range, and as we're driving there, he brought his .357. And as I'm holding the gun, I see there's notch marks in the bottom of his gun. And I turned to my father, and I said, Dad, why are there notch marks in the bottom of your gun? And he turns to me, and he says, why the hell do you think there are notch marks in the bottom of my gun? And so, of course, you take that in a little bit. And as a 18, 19-year-old, you kind of go, oh, my gosh. And then you get these little tiny bits and pieces of stories. And when about 5 years ago when we were in Detroit, I finally asked my father, I heard he was in this unit called STRESS. And I said, what is this STRESS unit? What is it all about? And he finally sat down and he told me the whole story of STRESS. And I about fell over in my chair. I just couldn't believe what had happened, what the unit did, the consequences of that unit, was incredible. And I said, oh my gosh, Dad, you know, we got to, you know, we got to share this story. And of course, he gave me that sideways glance and said, nobody's talking to you, including me. But over time, it took me about a year, when my father finally agreed to be interviewed by me, it started to open the door to some of the other people in that unit. He was able to get me in touch with several people, including Ray Peterson.
Yeah, now Ray Peterson is the name you mentioned, and he's important because?
So Ray Peterson's important because he was involved in 9 of the fatal shootings. He was the decoy crew. It was Stress Crew 1. Now, Stress was made up of more than just decoy. It was about 100 guys, but only 20 of them did the decoy work because it was insanity. You're going to these police officers and you're saying, look, we want you to volunteer for this stress unit. There'll be no extra pay, but here's what we want you to do. We want you to go dressed as plain clothes and go into the worst parts of Detroit. We want you to wander around, pretend to be drunk, pretend to be lost. We want you to try and get robbed. And then when the robber comes up and he's face to face with you, we want you to arrest him. But don't worry, you're going to have 2 to 3 guys backing you up. Now, they'll be 100 yards away, but they'll come and help you as soon as something bad happens. I mean, can you imagine being asked to do something like this? And these guys volunteered to do it.
And what was happening when, if we're thinking of Detroit and what we see in your film, in Detroit in early 1971, this is 3.5 years after the big racial explosion, the rebellion of 1967. So what was going on with crime in Detroit that caused the DPD to say, we need to do this?
That's a great question. And it's so important and vital to this story because so many people forget about what it was like in Detroit in 1970. You had a murder rate that was up 300% from a decade earlier, and you had a robbery rate that was up 600% from a decade earlier. And the problem was, is when they were robbing you, in all likelihood, they were going to kill you because they didn't want a witness. And so the police show up, and you've got a dead body and no witnesses. Now what do you do? So the chief at the time, his name was Chief Nichols, got his crew together along with a guy named Inspector Bannon, and they decided that they wanted to start doing this proactive policing. This is where they were going to go out and try and find these guys who were doing these crimes and arrest them. But, of course, the problem was when you have a gun to your head and a knife to your stomach and you're being robbed, do you wait to get shot? You mean, cause, and again, they have to wait until they actually get robbed. So they can't make the arrest until the robbery happens. But after the robbery, in all likelihood, you're going to get shot. And so the stress officers, of course, start shooting first. And it causes a big uproar in the city as it continues. And it was just a horrible position to put these police officers in. But at the same time, something had to be done.
And how effective was Stress, David? What happened to Detroit's crime rate over those 2 or 3 years that it was in operation?
So Stress was extraordinarily effective. Death is always a great deterrent. And when you've got these criminals out there and they start realizing and seeing what's happening with Stress, then you watch the robbery rate start to plummet. And the murder rate, however, continues to climb. But they were extraordinarily successful in creating a decrease in the robbery rate. But with anything else, there are consequences to that.
Yeah. At what social cost? What about police citizen killings? What happened in Detroit there?
After the first year of Stress, Detroit is the number one city where civilians are getting killed. But it's also the number one city where police are getting killed. So it really had consequences on both sides. And a lot of people forget that as well. They look at the 26 fatal shootings, which, of course, you know, are a consequence of that. But they forget about all the police officers that were not only killed, but the ones that were, you know, brutally shot that survived.
When you stop and you think about that evolving and then Coleman Young running for mayor in Detroit in 1973, promising to eliminate the stress units, and he's elected and he does. What happened to crime then?
Here's the interesting thing. So when Coleman Young's whole platform was to disband Stress, Stress was very unpopular at that point in 1973. The black community felt disenfranchised. Remember looking at history, 1964, you have the civil rights movement, but Detroit doesn't change. It stays the same. There's still an incredible amount of racism. There's still an incredible amount of pushing the black community into these two sections of the city called Black Bottom and Paradise Valley, where it's, you know, high rent, bad conditions. And so it's kind of this tinderbox that happens. And the communities continues to be outraged. And so Coleman Young steps in, sees it as an opportunity, and says, look, we're going to disband the stress unit. So in 1974, when he wins the election, he disbands stress, and the crime rate goes all the way back up to pre-stress levels. It was almost like he was giving the city a pass. And not only that, what was really interesting is that Coleman Young's personal security were all stress officers. He moved them from stress to his personal security.
When you think of the officers, you say there was about 100 in the unit, only about 20 or so actually acted as decoys. So who volunteered? And I'm wondering particularly, any officers of color?
There was. So Stress actually had a black decoy crew called Stress Crew 7. And it was made up of three African-American men who volunteered for the unit. And they would, of course, go out and do the same thing. Now, what was interesting about Stress as well is that within the police department at that time, racism was rampant. It was horrible. There were guys that were getting assigned a African-American partner, and they were putting up a piece of cardboard in their car between them.
Yeah, we actually heard that story from former Detroit Police Chief Ike McKinnon, and he described what it was like for him as a rookie officer, and absolutely fit with that. He even had weapons drawn on him as a police officer heading home during the rebellion of 67. That is, yeah, we certainly explored that. So what was the result then of having that stress unit operating? How did that impact racism in the department?
So what's interesting is that within the stress unit itself, there really was no racism. They really worked together well, and they worked together as a unit. And even though they had specific missions and targeted areas where sometimes they would only use, the African-American crew, and then the white crew would go to somewhere else, they would mix and they would, you know, pair up for certain decoy missions and so forth. And so I think it was a very different level of policing, almost like men who join the military and are in combat together. Because really, when you look at Detroit at that time, really was almost a combat zone.
So crime goes down while the stress units are on the streets. Crime goes back up, rebounds, ricochets back up when it was eliminated. So were law-abiding citizens hurt by the units, or were they hurt when the units were disbanded?
So, you know, it depends on your view, of course. The black community living in Detroit has every right to be upset. The racism and the way that they were treated was horrific. At the same time, I'll tell you a quick story about, you know, a cousin of my father's. Her name was Roberta, and she was deaf. And she wanted to live in the city. She loved the vibe of the city. She loved the culture. And so she moved into the city. And as she's coming home late one night, she comes in the house. And what she doesn't hear is that there's two people that are robbing her house. And as she comes in, they brutally attack her and kill her. My father went to the scene, and he said that there was blood everywhere. He said she put up a hell of a fight, but they killed her. Now, was my family concerned about the people that were there bombing it? Were they hurt by this? Absolutely. You know, did they care what the economic circumstances were of the people that were in there robbing them? Not at that point, because it's personal. So if you're one of the people that's been attacked, or you're one of the people that's been robbed, or one of your family members has been killed, you're extraordinarily upset that stress isn't there. If you're on the other side of the issue, and you're upset at the amount of shootings that are happening by police against the African-American communities, then for you, it's a different take. So, and that's why this is so controversial, right? It's so difficult to come up with the right solution, because when you have such an aggressive and proactive policing solution, you're going to have consequences that are going to be impactful to people on the other side, right? Because the people that they shot, even though they were robbing someone or committing crimes, they have families as well. And so it's a very tough situation.
How did your dad feel about the film once he saw it all done?
You know, my dad's a very hard man, as you can imagine. And when you hear some of the things that he did in the film, you kind of get a different flavor of maybe how I grew up. He's not, he never beat us. He didn't hit us. But he was, you know, he was a hard man. And when I first made my first cut of this film, I wanted to run it by him, of course. And I thought, oh my God, he's going to, because we do show both sides. You know, we have Mayor Kenneth Cockrell, who was mayor of Detroit previously, Ron Scott, who was not only involved in the anti-stress movement, but has been an advocate against police brutality all of his life. Melba Boyd, who was related to three men who were basically at war with stress and were shooting stress officers, and tells her side of the story. And so, you know, you have these things in the film that relay both sides. And I thought, oh, my God, you know, he's just going to tear this apart. He's going to be angry. He sat down and watched the whole film, didn't say a word. And when it ended, you know, I just looked over and I said, Dad, what did you think? And he just looked at me and he said, that's good. I said, that's it? He's like, yeah. He said, you told the whole story. And I said, you know, you're not upset at anything. You don't want to change anything. And he says, nope. He goes, that's what happened. And that was it. And, you know, and he's talking about, you know, some of the, you know, pretty bad things he did. And I think a lot of these guys, now that they're getting older, realize that this was their chance to tell their story. And so they really opened up, you know, especially, you know, Ray Pearson. Jesus, that was an incredible interview. And talk about a hard man. I tell people, regardless of whether you were a good guy or a bad guy, you did not want to come across Ray Pearson. He's not the guy you wanted to interact with at all.
Was he the commander, stress commander?
He was what they called the crew chief of Stress Crew One. He was one of the first people that they brought in. And you know, back in that time, too, you know, you had the supervisors were all World War II guys. And then the stress officers were, most of them were Korean, Vietnam vets. So, you know, you have these, you know, people that have been involved in war and those type of strategies, and they're bringing them to the police department. And that was another reason why, you know, it was so aggressive, was because the people that were running it were all military guys, really. And the people that were, you know, on the ground had been through Vietnam. So, you know, they wanted to go home at night.
David Van Wee, as you go around the country screening the film, which you've been doing for the last year, and by the way, racking up a number of awards to date, what kind of audience reactions, what kind of comments are you getting?
It's all across the same thing. It's all across the board. We've had people walk out of the theater because they're furious about it. We've had people walk up and say, you know, thank you so much for finally letting the police officers have a voice. Because what's interesting about this as well is that typically we never hear from the police officer. And remember, the stress guys haven't talked to anybody in almost 50 years. We've never heard from them. And that's another thing that makes this so compelling, is you finally see the impact that this type of work had on them, and the impact on their side of having their friends and their fellow officers killed. And we kind of forget that piece. It's very easy to get into the narrative that, you know, that these were just white racist killers out to kill black people. You know, was there some racism involved? Did they do horrible things? Sure there was, absolutely. But I also think it's a product of what they were sent to do. And so the audiences have been great. There's only been one that they had to shut down in Connecticut because it got a little heated. But beyond that, people have been very respectful. Everybody has shared their views on both sides. And it really, the purpose of the film is to continue that conversation about how do we solve this crime, because it's happening right now in Chicago.
Well, as you pose the question in the trailer to your film, how do you stop crime in a city out of control?
Yes, and if you listen to what Rahm Emanuel's statement was, well, we just need to instill more values and more morals. Well, that's great, but that's going to take quite a while to start turning that, if that's necessarily what needs to be done. How do you help those families and that three-year-old that was shot this weekend today?
The film is Detroit Under Stress. It'll be screened this coming Thursday as part of the second annual I See You Award, 7:30 p.m. Thursday at the Imagine Theaters in Royal Oak, right there on North Main Street. And David Van Wee will hold a question and answer session after the screening to keep that conversation going. David Van Wee, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Today's Stateside was directed by Lindsay Scullin and engineered by Rusty Brock. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, April Van Buren, Joy Huron, Sarah Leeson, Sam Corey, and Sophie Sherry. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.